RHI documents have revealed that another cousin of Andrew Crawford, Harlene Foster's former ministerial advisor, applied for three RHI boilers just before cost controls were implemented. It has already been revealed that Mr. Crawford passed a confidential ministerial submission which warned that cost controls were imminent to several relatives. In April, it was revealed that his cousin, Richard Crawford, who has six RHI boilers, was sent the confidential information, although Richard Crawford says it played no part in his decision to apply. Dr. Crawford sent the same submission to another relative, Wallace Gregg, who did not install any boilers. When that was revealed publicly, Dr. Crawford admitted to inappropriate behaviour. Now it's been revealed that a third relative, John Crawford of Ocher, applied for three boilers 2 days before the subsidy was cut. The newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, with us this morning. What do you make of this, Sam?
I think it really adds to the picture here. I think the most interesting aspect of this is the degree of concern, if not alarm, that this triggered at the top of Stormont in December 2016. So at the height of the scandal, after the BBC Spotlight programme, then after Jonathan Bell's interview with you, there was clearly a febrile atmosphere. There was concern about what might be coming out next. And it's clear that in that period, it was known to the senior DUP figures, Timothy Johnston, at least, and certainly some of the other people, such as Richard Bullock and potentially Arlene Foster herself, that Andrew Crawford's cousin Richard, or sorry, his cousin John Crawford, had got in on this literally the last day before the scheme was reined in. Now, that led to advice from Andrew McCormick, who was the most senior civil servant in the economy department at that point, that really it was better for them not to try to fudge that in any way, that really it was better to just get this out. And that seems to have been the advice from David Gordon as well, who was then the executive press secretary. That, of course, didn't happen. But what Dr. McCormick said was that it's not what it is, but it's what it seems to be. I just don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was words to that effect, where he was saying it's not that this proves that he did something wrong or improper or illegal, but in the current atmosphere, where the allegation from some quarters is that people in the DUP, and we now know that the person who civil servants believed was behind this was Andrew Crawford, people in the DUP were believed to have delayed cost controls. If it then looks like he delayed cost controls and some of his relatives got in as a direct consequence of that, it was very obvious to those people with a little bit of a more objective view on things and perhaps people in the DUP. It was very clear to them that that was a major problem hurtling down the tracks towards the party. That, of course, didn't happen. Andrew Crawford resigned for other reasons. And there is other evidence which has emerged about Richard Crawford and about passing documents and all of the rest of it, which you've referred to there. But really, this adds to the picture that this link with his family is not a one-off. There is a pattern emerging here at the inquiry.
And if we remember back to December 2016, Sam, the atmosphere and the discussion in politics in Northern Ireland, where you had the DUP saying, well, look, there's nothing much to see here. Why are journalists whipping this up into a frenzy? And yet there was something to see, and they had a decision at that time, as you've just said. Do they give the public the information around which questions are being asked, or do they not? And they decided that they would not put the information into the public domain, which leads to the question, nearly 2 years later, why not?
That's right. And I think from the DUP's point of view, they will say there was no need for them to volunteer this information. There was no legal reason why they had to do it. And that is all well and good. But I think if you're trying to tell the public that you're being entirely upfront, if you're trying to then criticise journalists who are reporting what little we knew at that point, we now know so much more about what was going on, it doesn't look terribly good for them at this point. What we are told by Dr. McCormick is that in mid-December 2016, Timothy Johnston, who at that point was really the key special advisor to Arlene Foster. He's now the very powerful DUP chief executive figure, and really some people say the key figure within the party at any level, even though he's perhaps not very well known if you were to meet him in the street. But this is somebody who at that point, with all of the responsibilities and all of the authority that he had, he went to Andrew McCormick and he asked him to check out further details of Andrew Crawford's relatives' RHI installations. Now, Dr. McCormick says that he assumed that he had either known beforehand that they were beneficiaries, or he had noticed the names in a list which he had asked to see on Friday the 9th of December, so just 3 days after the BBC Spotlight programme. So from a very early stage in this scandal, when it blew up in early December, it was known to senior DUP figures that there was a family link between Andrew Crawford, who they also knew, it was alleged, was the person who had tried to delay cost controls. We didn't know that at that point. It wasn't public, but they knew that. It's very clear they knew that. They knew that from Andrew McCormick. And so there were bits of the jigsaw that were available to the DUP that we didn't see. And yet, in terms of what they said publicly, it was very dismissive. It was very much, as you say, there's very little to see here, and we're getting on with fixing it, and that's
that. It was more than that, Sam. It was very much, what are you up to asking these questions?
That's right. And I think, I mean, the point here is that when you look at all of this in the round, it's very difficult looking back at what the DUP said in that period to justify what they said as being telling the whole truth. That they knew, they will say that they certainly did not lie about anything, that they carefully phrased their statements. But it's very clear that they knew a lot more of what had gone on, and things which were causing them great concern, which were causing considerable concern to people at the very upper tier of the civil service, who normally don't get involved in these sorts of intra-party things. But this was causing deep concern, and there was a belief among some of the civil service people that it was better for the party to just get this over with. They really felt that it was going to come out anyway. It was clear at that point that the names of RHI beneficiaries at some point were going to be published, and really they were saying it's just better to get this over with. But that, of course, is not what the party decided to do.
Yesterday, Counsel to the Inquiry David Schofield QC asked Dr. Andrew McCormick about the non-introduction of cost controls.
One of the other issues that the inquiry has to grapple with on this topic, which is the non-introduction of the cost controls, which had been consulted upon in phase two, is why it may be that those cost controls were not simply introduced along with the domestic scheme. Mm-hmm. You'll know from your more recent reading of the consultation document that the cost control applied to both sides mm-hmm. of the scheme, domestic and non-domestic. Is there any evidence that you can offer as to why you think wasn't pursued?
I can't understand why those things weren't pursued.
What did you think? Who do you think, or how was the decision to prioritise the domestic scheme in this way? Who took that decision? Who was advised by it?
I don't know. I can tell you,
you share a lot of other witnesses. Nobody to date has taken responsibility for that.
So I think there is a rationale for it, in that the domestic market is very significant in heat, and so getting renewables into the domestic sector is inherently a big thing to do.
Oh yes, but how you do it?
Yes, your point is your question is entirely.
Mr. Mills assumes it was the minister. There's no indication that the minister did it, or if the minister did it, there was any submission. There's no record of why the cost controls were removed.
I don't know, and I've no additional insight into the documentation that I've read that resolves that. I think it is. I find it frustratingly mysterious.
We know the minister said that this needs to be prioritised. Is it not unusual to the level of being extraordinary that there is not a submission and or a minute to say, yes, this is the way it will be prioritised?
And in addition to that, here are the consequences of prioritising.
Yes,
I agree that that's impossible to explain or defend.
Yeah.
impossible to explain or defend, Sam. I don't know. It's mysterious. My goodness, there's a lot still to come.
There is, and I think what Dr. McCormick said yesterday and what he says in his written evidence is very much in line with the stance which he adopted at the Public Accounts Committee in late 2016 and is very similar to the stance adopted by David Stirling, who's now the head of the civil service, where for the most part they are quite open and upfront about the major failures by the civil service. This is a massive failure to not document a decision not to introduce cost controls on a scheme, who took that decision, why they took it, when it was going to be revisited. I mean, it is so fundamental to what was to develop on the scheme. It is impossible to explain in any rational way. And I think there was a culture clearly within the civil service, we know, where they weren't writing things down deliberately on some occasions. It's not clear if this was a deliberate decision or if this was just something that didn't happen for some other reason. But they were not writing things down on some occasions because they felt it would potentially leak out. It would lead to freedom of information requests. And that was something which the DUP in particular and also Sinn Féin weren't terribly keen on. And while that might have seemed attractive to some of those people at that point, and it might have pleased some of their political masters, it's something which now is to the detriment of the civil service because they have no piece of paper on many of these big decisions involving the RHI scheme to say, well, actually, this was a decision that we pushed against, that we queried, that we raised issues about. There is no evidence of that whatsoever, and because they just weren't recording what ought to have been really pretty basic functions of government. And when you contrast that with some of the records that we do see released, so we had records released yesterday where they were recording an internal investigation into why Jonathan Bell didn't get an invitation to meet Boris Johnson in Ballymena. I mean, it's really extraordinary to try to understand how that is recorded, and yet something of such fundamental magnitude in the RHI scheme, which they knew at that point was going to run for 20 years into the future, why that was not recorded by anybody.
Well, and I don't think the public are stupid. If we also then, Sam, look at the fact that the public now know that Jonathan Bell was taping people who he was interacting with, why don't you talk us through the secret tape recordings, which some of us have known about for quite a long time?
Well, this stems back to the 12th of December 2016, when Jonathan Bell had arranged to go and meet Andrew McCormick at his old department. There is a convention whereby former ministers can go and view the papers from their time in office. They're not allowed to take them away or photocopy them, but they're allowed to view them. He had arranged to make use of that facility. He arrived at Netherley, which is just outside the Stormont Estate on Massey Avenue, on the evening of the 12th of December. He had with him somebody who he had said he was bringing as a researcher, but when that person arrived, it was somebody called Ken Cleland, who is known to some people around Stormont. He was somebody who at one point was close to Peter Robinson, somebody who sits on the Maes Long Cash Development Corporation. He was put there by the DUP and Sinn Féin. And when they came into the meeting room, they said that Andrew McCormick was probably wondering what had brought the two of them together. And they then went on to explain that they had become close companions in Christian fellowship. It then went on in a section of what was not recorded, but Dr. McCormick has recounted in his written evidence, that they presented themselves as seekers after truth. And he said, indeed, they potentially had presented themselves as agents of righteousness. So very much a religious overtone to what was happening here. Andrew McCormick is a Christian. They knew he's a Christian. So from his evidence, there is a sense that perhaps he now feels that they were trying to use that to allay some of what may have been his suspicions about what was happening. He says that then Mr. Cleland said that he had said that he had a prophecy about Jonathan Bell and about the RHI scheme. So really quite unusual language for a situation of this nature.
So this was God sending them to Jonathan Bell on this mission. Meanwhile, Jonathan Bell had a tape recorder up his coat.
I think that's certainly a pretty concise summary of what Dr. McCormick feels happened. He did not know he was being recorded. He then says that after about a year, in last December of 2017, he ran into Ken Cleland at an event in Belfast. He asked him about this, And Mr. Cleland said that he hadn't realised that the recording was happening, but he didn't give any explanation as to why he had been brought along by Mr. Bell. And really, there is still a considerable degree of mystique around this whole incident. The transcript of certainly much of what transpired there, if not all of it, has now been submitted to the inquiry. It's been published by the inquiry. And that is something which Dr. McCormick is probably unlikely to be questioned about today, because I don't think they will get perhaps to that phase. But Mr. Bell, who is going to be there later this week, almost certainly will be asked about that and what was in his mind at that point.
And I know, Sam, I know that the position that Andrew McCormick was then in when he found himself, when he found that he had knowledge that he had been taped. So he's then in the position in the middle of this massive media frenzy where he's trying to remember, what did he say? What was he asked? And more to the point, what did he not say? Or how could it be construed? And that was a pretty distressing time for Andrew McCormick. He was under an immense amount of pressure.
That's right. And it's very clear from reading through his written evidence that he was under immense mental strain at that point. He felt that he had let down the civil service, that he had let down his minister. He felt that he had spoken in too candid a manner. He couldn't remember, as you say, exactly what he had said. He thought he had said things that were worse than he actually had said. And really, he was in a situation where there was almost a gun to his head, where Mr. Bell was threatening to release this recording. There was then some consideration of Dr. McCormick doing an interview with you, actually, to try to preempt that. And really, he was trying to grapple with things which most senior civil servants would never really have to encounter. And Dr. McCormick is somebody who, in his evidence, comes across as very cool, as very experienced, collected, calm. That is not the impression which he gives of his own mental demeanour at that point, where he was under so much strain about this.
So where does this go next, Sam?
Well, I think just one final point on that. I think one of the very significant things which Dr. McCormick says about the transcript of this recording...
There were other people taped, by the way, I can tell you that.
That's right. And he says that I would highlight that the approach taken by Jonathan Bell in the conversations appears to include a carefully prepared set of detailed questions. It appears that he had limited direct recall of the events that were covered during his time as minister. Hence, some of his comments in the television interview with Stephen Nolan were not well-founded. Now, that I think is quite significant, because what he is suggesting there is that a lot of what Mr. Bell presented very forcefully as his own knowledge actually stemmed from this secretly recorded conversation with Dr. McCormick. And the question then, which I think the inquiry will be asking of Mr. Bell, is how much did he actually know about this at the time? Was it that he was a minister who was in the department who was across all of this, or was it, as his special advisor Timothy Kearns has suggested in his evidence, that really he was almost left to run aspects of the department at points, and Mr. Bell really wasn't taking a great interest in some of the minutiae of what was going on?
When's Jonathan Bell appear?
He's going to be up tomorrow, so we should see his written evidence later today. And we also had a clear indication for the first time yesterday from Sir Patrick Coughlan, who is chairing the inquiry, that this is now likely to be complete in terms of the public evidence sessions by the end of this year. Actually, by the end of October, we should have all of the witnesses through, and then by the start of December, there should be closing submissions. It's not clear, and he hasn't given any indication of when his final report will be published, but there is, for the first time, I suppose, some sort of timetable as to when this whole process will come to a conclusion.
Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed.